Is this me or is this you?
It's not me.
Sorry. That was me. What was that? Sorry.
Are you listening to podcasts while we're doing the podcast?
How's the podcast just started playing on my phone?
This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Safely into the FA Cup final with a comfortable win at Wembley, and then a Wednesday night to remember as Manchester City piled even more pressure on Arsenal with a complete dismantling at the Etihad. The Gunners still lead the table, but City's hot breath is right on their necks as they sit just 2 points behind with two games in hand. Welcome to this very special Blue Moon podcast. It's episode 500, 13 years, 8 months and 19 days, and 14 major trophies, and crucially, one podcast award. After our very first recording, I can't explain how happy I am that Wednesday night's game went the way it did. Good vibes only in the studio for today, I can promise you that. I'm David Mooney, and a special show deserves special guests. With me, I've got two former City defenders. I'm joined by Nader Manua.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you.
And congratulations as well. 500 is awesome.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely awesome, yeah.
And joining us also, Keith Cole.
Hi, David.
Thank you for joining us, Keith. Thank you for coming in. Let's talk then. We'll start, for the first part of the show, we'll start about City and Arsenal and the general situation at the moment. Keith, what will that dressing room have been like the moment that all the players got back into it on Wednesday night?
I think probably there's an anticipation. They've had a job to do. There would have been nerves because they know the enormity of the task in hand, but the way they went out and the way that they played, they seemed so relaxed, so understanding again. But I think there's a focus because they know the job's not done, but they know what the job is. So I'm not saying they would have been relieved after the game, but there's a focus about the group that you can tell. They know what they're about individually and collectively, and they know that they've done their job last night.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if it would have focused minds in the sense of, okay, everyone thinks the job is done, but it ain't done yet.
Everyone being who?
The players.
After the game, you mean?
Yeah.
So I was looking down at them at the final whistle, and there were a few cheers, but it's just like a pat on the back. Went over, you know, shook some Arsenal players' hands, got involved in a few fights, but then they walked off because they know that it's not done yet, but they know that the tables have turned now, because I think for most of the season they've had to watch what Arsenal are doing.
Yeah.
Because they need to know what they need to do in their games, whereas now Arsenal will have to be watching City, hoping that they can do them a favour. And the way they played, like, it's reward because they've obviously got all the talent in the world, but it looked so prepared yesterday. Mm. Tactically, they knew what they needed to do. Individually, they were, like, doubly motivated to make sure they got things across the line. The fans were great. The atmosphere was incredible. And that's, like, that City at their best at this point in the season. It's like they come alive. And for those players, they did it. They didn't do it comfortably. They did it well. They did it well. They played really well.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, when I say comfortably, it wasn't an easy game. They made it easy.
They made it look easy or made it feel easy?
The way that they played was they stuck to their plan, and their plan was the better plan. Mm. I think Arsenal, in my opinion, I don't know if you agree, Keith, didn't. I feel like they came and expected John Stones to go into midfield. So the way that they were trying to defend City was based around that, which is why all of a sudden Edison can put his foot on the ball and stay there for 10 seconds, because they're probably trying to decide, well, who's supposed to go to him? This isn't something that we sort of legislate for. And I don't think they made the necessary tweaks to be able to affect that, because now, looking at it, City probably had 15 minutes worth of possession where Edison or the centre-backs just had it and there was nobody coming near to them.
Yeah.
So that draws Arsenal out. Some of the movements, like, people were working hard, they were tracking back, they were running forward together and they're making the right decisions. And like I said, it made it look comfortable, but Arsenal, playing like that, would probably win against maybe 80% of the league. But City somehow just limited their options. They were aggressive when Arsenal had the ball. And they kind of knew Arsenal didn't want to stretch the game in behind as well. And when teams do that and become one-dimensional, that level of aggression, it makes it easier. But it, like I say, it's not easy, because they did play against society who are still technically top of the league.
But yeah.
Don't you think that, or how much time do you think goes into Pep's thinking of the opposition? Because you get a lot of coaches nowadays, the focus is on what they're going to do and how we're going to play as a team. But you get the feeling that Pep's going to think, right, well, if we I think they're going to think we're going to set up like this. Yeah. So they're going to do this. This is going to be their mindset of how they're going to stop us from playing. And when they do that, this is how we bypass that.
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, they are the next level on.
Yeah.
Not only as coaches and as players, but as a team. So they can counter a counter attack. So yeah, it's like inviting the press and say, so as soon as we get them to come and press us, we want them to press us,
yeah,
and then we're going to bypass it. And when we bypass it,
yeah,
this is a movement. So it's gone very quickly going on to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Which unfortunately, with a lot of coaches, it falls down on trying to keep possession and inviting the press, because
exactly.
That's the risk and the reward.
Yeah, it's possession with a purpose, isn't it?
Definitely.
And interestingly, we look back at the game against Bayern Munich, and for as much as the first leg was great in the way they played, in the second leg, the decisive moment is John Stones kicking it long, Haaland heading it down to De Bruyne playing in Haaland scoring. There's an element of simplicity that still comes for it. And I thought in that game yesterday as well, I remember earlier in the season, City played against Brighton, and Brighton were really good in that game.
Yeah,
they were really good.
Yeah.
And they were aggressive in their press. They went sort of man-to-man at the back, as, say, Arsenal did yesterday. And there were times where City, and the same was in the Arsenal game in the FA Cup, City would go longer to Haaland. But I felt like the thing that was missing was what would happen next.
The link.
Yeah, whereas yesterday, the timing of the link, it's like they knew.
There was a number of times, wasn't there? De Bruyne was, I mean, he was...
Like, came on, he knew.
He was in arm's length of Haaland at times, because he knew he was going to get the flick.
And there's... In my opinion, there's certain things which are quite simple in football. When the ball goes over your head, you turn and you go in that other direction as quick as you can to anticipate that second ball. And De Bruyne, for his goal, he started off 2 yards behind Partey and finished off 2 yards in front of Partey.
Yeah.
But he knew the ball was going to Haaland. Great hold-up play by him. Great set. And that changes the dynamic, because it's not just a hopeful long ball. I'll just stick, let it stick up there. Yeah. Make it happen. There's structure to this. And I think that's because they know that's something that they have to do going forward. Because if you're going to have the big guy up there, it's great when he's by himself, but it's even better when you've got players coming underneath to go and take the ball and take the territory.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, on the flip side, what will the Arsenal dressing room be like now? Because they've picked up 3 points from the last possible 12 now, and it was in their hands, it's now in City's hands. Is there a case of you get back into that dressing room and everybody's kind of slumped down and... Like what's a City just basically crushing the spirit at the moment? Is that what's going on?
Again, I think very much now Arteta will be thinking about himself, his team, and they're still top of the league. And that's what they've got to focus on now. You know, they've got to win every game from now until the end of the season. And that's what his focus will be now. Yeah. Like they've been beat by City. Not a disgrace. Yeah, a football club doesn't fall apart, or a team doesn't fall apart because...
Okay, we start again.
We start again. Right, our job from now to the end of the season is we've got to win every one of our games from now to the end of the season. If it's good enough, excellent, we accept it and we win the league. If City falter in any way... Yeah, that's down to them. Mm. But our focus has got to be on us and what we do individually, collectively, as a team.
Yeah.
And again, you've got to say, from last night, it wasn't evident why Arsenal are top in the league. But you've got to give them credit, because they are there for a reason. They've been there for a reason.
Absolutely.
But it's no disgrace to be to get beat by City.
Yeah. To put it into perspective, if they win their last games, they finish on 90 points.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to finish on 80 and say, oh, it's a bit of a scruffy season. It's 90 points. And most seasons, that's more than enough.
Yeah.
And you do wonder for them now, like, the aim is to win those five. But for them to be having to watch City hoping they drop points, whilst also knowing themselves that they can't afford to drop points, I think that's the...
Does that pressure get to you?
Listen, everyone listening knows I was never involved in a title race, so I can't go into that too much.
Everyone has aims and objectives.
Yeah, do you know what? I'll give the example I can give. So when I was in a championship with QPR, we were one of the teams supposed to be up near the top, and it was us, Leicester and Burnley, and we went through a spell where we'd be winning, and then we checked the results, Leicester had won again. Leicester went on a 21 or 23 unbeaten streak, and the vast majority of those were wins. So when you think you're going to make ground and you check the scoreline and see that you haven't made up anything, that's not nice. But then when you drop points and you see what they've done and they've not dropped points, it can be a bit demoralising. And I think for this Arsenal side, if I was to think what their dressing room would be like, you know, they can say, come on, boys, it's not over. But it doesn't feel the same as it would have done 2 weeks ago when they say, come on, it's not over, after drawing at Anfield. Because now that's four results now, where they would think that they should have done better.
Mm.
And now they know, as they walk out, they're going to face a lot of criticism, there's going to be a lot of questions asked. And the next game, you know, it's against Chelsea. I don't know if this is like 2023 Chelsea or like a different Chelsea that might do it. But, you know, at this point, they've become the underdog. Does that suit them? Maybe. Does it suit them against Man City?
Probably not.
Yeah, that's the downside for them, I think.
Well, I've got two great defenders in the studio. Let's talk about the defence. I know City have just won 4-1, but I want to talk about the way they did it at the back, because, Keith, that John Stones and Ruben Dias partnership was back together. And as Nadim said before about Arsenal possibly planning for John Stones to move into midfield, he didn't. In terms of a centre-back and a partner, what's it like having somebody next to you who you can just depend on?
Yeah, I think that reliability of their decision-making and that understanding of you know where someone's going to be is vital. And that's something that you pick up through a number of games that you get together. And sometimes there's nothing worse. I remember being 2-0 up against Man United for Man City, and we're cruising and the game's comfortable.
I was going to say I remember it well, but well isn't the right word.
No, I remember it. And again, the ball's come out, the ball's come in, Michael Vonk, and you're thinking, all you got to do, Michael, just edit straight back over the halfway line. Tries being clever because we're 2-0 up and he wants to showboat, and he tries heading it down. Next thing, it's 2-1, then it's 2-all, then it's 3-2. By one mistake, one error, one decision making, that reliability.
Change the flow of the game.
Yeah, completely. It's do what you need to be doing. Again, but then, as a partnership, it's vitally important that you've got that understanding. And I was lucky enough. I played with some very good defenders, not only as a partner, but also in a back four and in a back three. And I was always the one that played deep because I wanted to be seeing what everybody else was doing, and I could control what everybody else was doing because I had pace and I could cover them. I didn't like to be the one that was reliant on somebody else. Mm. But that was just me as an individual, how I played.
Yeah. Mm. I looked up the stats. Do you know who you played? Do you know which defender you played alongside the most at City?
When I first went there, I played with Colin Endre, then it was Steve Redmond, then it was Michael Vonk.
There's no centre backs in this list. They're all full backs.
Alan Kernaghan.
It was Terry Phelan. You played with 91 times at City, and then Andy Hill 85 times, and then Michel Vonk 73 times.
I had it with Alan Kernaghan. A good defender just came from Middlesbrough, and I'd had an understanding with Michael Vonk how I played, how we played offside. This was back in the day when you could just catch people offside by, and it's one of those. I'd give Alan Kernaghan the signal, and he wouldn't do it. And I'm like, so I'm pushing up, playing offside, and he's dropping off. So that relationship didn't last long until we had to have a sit down and have a conversation. But Alan, so if I give you the signal, no is the only thing that cancels it, but then you've got to tell me. Otherwise, it looks like we're not on the same page. Yeah. In the end, it was one of I knew then, very quickly, I picked up, Alan wasn't comfortable playing offside. Yeah. So then I have to change my
change
game.
What you're doing.
And say, right, now we defend deep then. Mm. Or I'll go and win the header, which that wasn't my strong point. I wanted to go for second ball.
Mm. Yeah. Nadim, do you know the players you played alongside most in the defence?
Richard Dunn.
Yeah, 86 times.
Wouldn't have been Company. I can't think who else.
Micah.
Yeah.
47 times.
Yeah.
Sylvain Distan, 46.
Yeah, it's not a bad three, is it?
Yeah, it's a good trio. That. It's not back four.
Do you know what Keith was saying as well? Like, every defender is kind of different, but when you find someone that's on the same wavelength as you, like, it's great to be out there. Mm. But then I think for that City game yesterday, you've got obviously Dias and Stones, but it's also the fact Edison's there as well. You know what I mean? Like, those three play the ball to each other more than any other. Say, when those two are at the back, they know that if they're aggressive, Edison's sweeping up behind. Yeah. If you find a goalie who doesn't come off his line and the manager tells you to be aggressive, my friend, that's stress. That's hell on earth, that. Honestly, hell on earth. But the relationships are fantastic. And I think, best of all, with that City side, I never really pay attention to this until I hear someone talk about it from externally. The really big side. And then an aggressive side.
Yeah.
And they'll either pass you to death or kick you into rosette.
There was a point in the second half yesterday when Arsenal had a spell of possession, but it was all on the halfway line.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I looked up and Dias was on the halfway line. And I'm like, why are you there? Like, you are pressing so high up there.
Yeah, it's because they know that the balance is there.
Yeah.
Both will never go. One will go when it's the right time to go. But they understand, like, to tactically understand what you have to do, to sort of have the mentality to be able to do it as well and understand why you're doing it. And then to continue to do it, even if it makes you uncomfortable, because Ruben Dias isn't the quickest player in the City side, but he's not concerned about what's going on behind him because he knows that the right thing to do is to step forward and you've got cover behind you, whereas other people, because they're worried about their pace, will take a step back. But that step back is what affects everybody else.
Yeah.
If the manager wants you to take a step forward, go forward. That's it.
You know, when you watch the City play out, and you get a lot of teams, and you can tell that they focus on playing out, breaking lines, getting people arriving in pockets. Mm. But the thing that I notice about City is, it's not the negative to go back to Edison.
Yeah.
It's a reset.
Yeah.
Which means,
yeah,
and as soon as the ball goes back there, that it's like a trigger to reset your shape and put the onus on the opposition. How are you going to stop us again? Where you get a lot of teams, they see it as a negative going back to the goalkeeper. It's not. It's a reset.
Most of the goalkeepers, though, are like me, and they have two thoughts in their mind, and it's generally, oh God, I've got the ball at my feet, what am I going to do with it now? Edison is just like, there's just cool, calm, and...
I never thought I'd be watching a game of football where the goalkeeper can put his foot on top of it and just wait there for someone to come out. Yeah. But it makes perfect sense.
And let them get really close.
Exactly, yeah. No, not stress at all. Yeah. And best of all, everyone else around the field is staying in the positions that they know is right because they know the ball can get to them.
Yep.
Back in my time, you see the goalkeeper under a bit of pressure and you're sort of reacting to it, thinking maybe what's the worst thing that could happen here?
Yeah.
But instead for City, it's like...
I trust him, yeah.
Yeah, they trust him, they trust everyone on the field. And they trust him to make the right decisions. Yeah. Even the balls which they play to like Rodri or Gundogan where they've got two people pressing them. On the field, it feels like there's danger.
Yeah.
it's like a passing drill for those guys. Yeah.
But it's a kind of like a false danger, isn't it? Because the point is to make the sure that when you see like Ruben Dias for instance had a spell where he just had his foot on top of the ball and was almost saying to Odegaard, well, yeah, just come on, get this. Yeah. And then as soon as he makes the run, he goes, no, I'm just going to knock it round here. And then Gundogan's got it, and City are in. It's almost like that false danger where City know that they are in control of the situation and they want the opponents to go, we can have this. We can get it off you.
That how many times do you were you thinking? It seems like City have got an extra player.
Mm.
Whichever side of the pitch is on, you're thinking, like, well, how do I outnumber them this side?
That's Edison, though, isn't it? That's the role. The fact
sometimes,
that he's there.
Yeah.
For me, I think it depends whether they go with the two centre backs like they did yesterday, or they go with the back three.
Yeah.
If they go with the back three, they tend not to use Edison as much.
Yeah.
But when would they go with the two? Then that's it. So you can see three is the key number.
Yeah.
In terms of how they play and. To be honest, mate, it's amazing. But to talk about a detail, having played amateur football for the last year or so as well, the passes into midfield, there's so much detail that goes into it because they'll play the ball to the right side of the player that's going to be receiving it.
Yeah.
Safe side, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. They're not just kicking the ball to them. There's so much detail in terms of the weight of it, the angle of it, and so on and so forth. Whereas I think most people don't realise that's a thing. But if that wasn't being done that way, then it doesn't make any sense at all.
You can't position your body this way.
It's the movement and the timing of that support run from the midfield player of when he comes, because it's not always a straight run, is it? And sometimes somebody that's in that area, he vacates, but somebody else comes in there, and it's a set pass. You leave the ball in the space for somebody to come in, and then you get that rotation of play.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, two, three passes, they're out of there, and the opposition team's exposed.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, like, how has that happened?
It's like creating a counter-attack when you've got the ball.
It's inviting the press.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But you've got to be a very brave coach, and you've got to have very good players that believe in you and trust in you and understand it, because when it works, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
It looks so simple.
How would you have felt if Guardiola had come into City and said, I want you to do this?
I enjoyed the football.
I thought I knew you'd say that.
I was one of those defenders. I enjoyed the football. I think probably how I progressed through amateur league, I think I played in all the divisions. And I started out as a right winger so I could handle a football, and then having to become a defender and adopting a defensive mentality, you're thinking, I still like the football. Understand the other side of the game where you have to be competitive and you have to be a little bit aggressive at times, but ultimately I still like the football. Would have I enjoyed a coach, or did I? Probably the best coach that I had probably would have been as a football coach would have been Colin Lee, who I thought was very good and excellent about the detail involved in not only being a defender,
but in playing the ball
in playing the ball out and being constructive and building play from the back. I thought it was excellent, whereas before it was just case of like stop them from scoring, Keith, and that and job done.
We'll deal with the rest after that.
The game's changed completely now.
Yeah.
I know you'd be all right. I've seen you up close.
No. Okay, let me try and explain that to people as well, because some people will be uncomfortable with this. So professional footballers can pass a football.
Yeah.
Breaking news. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if a manager comes in and wants you to play more football, the next stage is like having the mentality to accept that and choosing to do it.
Mm.
But it's always easier when everyone else in the team's playing football as well. If one or two people on any side want to play football and others don't, it doesn't really work. Because say times yesterday when Akanji's playing left back and he's taking a touch because he's distinctly right-footed, he's got an option. And it's Ruben Diaz to stand in that point because he wants to receive the ball even though he's under pressure. And he's going to receive and pass it to the next person that wants to receive it because they're under pressure, yeah? And for me personally, looking back at my career, one of the things I was bad at was things like hitting channel balls and long balls. I was like, so if I didn't have to do that, I feel like I'd be a better player.
Yeah.
And if you had players who wanted to receive it, like some of the best football I played was when all of a sudden you've got David Silva in front of you who will receive it under pressure.
Yeah.
There you go, David, please enjoy. Yeah. As opposed to the old, old City, where you'd have the ball at your feet and you see a lot of numbers and hands in the air saying, go over there, point that way, point that way.
Do something with it down
there. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Then you play long ball, it doesn't work out. I was like, oh, God. Yeah, so like with Pep, I would love to get the chance to play in a system like this because I think he simplifies, even though it looks really complex, he simplifies it to a point. And you can tell by his coaching, because I thought it was so well drilled yesterday that everyone knew exactly what they want to do. And I think as a player, that's one of the greatest feelings when you step on the pitch and you know exactly what the plan is and you know you're surrounded by people who will do it and stick to it. So as a consequence, you don't have to do anything out of the ordinary. Be aggressive, be supported and receive the ball and you'll find people to pass it to as well.
You know what you mentioned there, hitting the channel ball.
Yeah.
People don't see that as, or players nowadays don't see that as an art form. I've been at Northampton, Oldham, and I've had players, defenders out hitting channel balls, and they can't do it.
Yeah,
but they won't go out and practice it. You give them a bag of balls and put, you know, this is the area that I want you to put the ball in. They don't see that as a skill, and it is a skill.
Yeah,
that ball is a difficult ball to hit.
It really
with the right pace, the right trajectory. So you're leaving the ball into a good area. But players nowadays, they don't want to go and practice that. And they think it's a great tool to have in your bag.
Mm. And and with that as well, it's even better when you've got a striker that will chase it down.
Oh,
because then it's like, did you see the time? Again,
I think I know what you're going to say.
This is a City podcast or whatever. We understand it. So Ruben Diaz just heads a ball down towards the corner.
Yeah.
And Rob Holding's running down, but Haaland's chasing him.
Yeah.
So next thing, because Haaland's chasing him, Holding just kicks it out for a throw-in.
Yeah.
You see Haaland's reaction?
Did he celebrate?
A double fist pump,
At times, for us, when we talk about false nines, inverted fullbacks, all this stuff, sometimes just chase a ball down the channel.
Yeah.
Territorial
you know
play
it, you'll
is
get
the
territory.
One.
Yeah. And that's what I love the most about this City backline and City in general. They could have 1,000 passes in a game, or they could be doing that and putting you under pressure and making you uncomfortable.
Yep.
And you see, that's why they're the total package and why people seem to both love them and hate them just as much.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Well, Nadim, you talked about Manuel Akanji. I want to bring in this from Johnny the Bakewell Blue, who's emailed to say, I'm watching the Cup semi and just wanted to ask if you think there's a better value for money signing anywhere this season than Manuel Akanji. We got him for less than £20 million. He's strong, tall, great in the air, fast, skillful and authoritative. Got to be a candidate for bargain of the season.
Yeah, I would say so. I don't think there is an award for bargain of the season.
There isn't. No, we could create one.
Yeah, not yet.
Yeah, but I think he's been great. I think he's exceeded a lot of people's expectations. You know, I knew him from watching him play for Dortmund. Mm. I'd seen him play for Switzerland, so I knew he was a good player. But after all those City players came back to fitness, you were thinking, well, maybe he's going to be out. But the big point for me, the big turning point in terms of my expectations of him, was when him and Ake played as centre-backs in the Manchester derby at home.
Yeah.
And you had Ruben Diaz and I think maybe like Laporte and stuff on the bench. And when for Pep to make that call in that game, which means as much to everyone associated with City, I thought, okay.
There's trust there.
There's some trust there. Yeah. And the performances have been fantastic. He's played right-back, then left-back, centre-back, right of the three. But then, like I say, it's when you really take a step back, we're stunned that a full Swiss international has done really well. You know, like what are we talking about?
Yeah, he's got all the credentials, hasn't he? As a natural defender, as a ball player, he can defend as well.
Yeah, exactly.
But he can play ball.
Yeah, yeah. It's did either of you ever have to play out of position on the wrong side? Because obviously he played left back. So
I played left back for England.
Yeah,
And I think I went to the Euros. And I played right back, so I was a centre back. made my name as a centre-back. And then I think it was Tony DiRigo, used to play for Leeds United. He not refused. He said he didn't want to play right-back. And I'm like, Graham Taylor came to speak to me and said, I'm going to play you, but you have got the option going, I'm going to play you at right-back, but I understand if you don't want to play there. I'm like, not a chance.
I will put that shirt on, yeah.
Give me that shirt, I'll go and play left-wing again. I don't mind, I will play anywhere. So I think I played three times for England. I played left-back, right-back, and sweeper. And
is it hard making that switch? If you're on your wrong side, because I am painfully right-footed. So like, if I get a pass back on my left-hand side, it's potluck where it's going. Mm. So is it hard when you switch sides?
I'm right-footed, or was right-footed, but I always played left-hand side centre-back. So I always felt comfortable on on the left-hand side. But then, but that was mainly because back in the day when you could squeeze play up, and I invited people to hit the channel ball because I could outpace centre forwards, and then I was going back and I was going on my right foot to pass the ball back. So I always felt comfortable. And keeping is it difficult? Yeah, it's slightly different back in the day when it was, because you hit more channel balls. You didn't have people come and get the ball off of you. There wasn't that rotation in play. It was like, you get it, you put it down into that area.
Yeah, I think if Akanji was to have been pressed from his right side to force him onto his left for 90 minutes,
it's different.
Yeah,
but when he can take a touch on his right foot and have the field open to know that Ruben Diaz is back there, to know there's a switcher play on his right side, like, you're basically playing into his strengths. And he basically played like a left side centre back. He had a job which he did very well on Saka. Sometimes he ran forward and all that stuff, but he didn't play that game as a left back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so as a consequence, it's visually different, but you know, it's
fundamentals are the same.
Yeah, essentially.
We spend a lot of time looking at Guardiola's lineup and going, well, he's actually playing like Bernardo left back or whatever. Yeah. He's like, he's not actually left back. He's playing
in defence.
He's named as a left back, but it's not.
Can I make a point here, actually? So tell me what you think about this. So before the game, the lineups came out, and if you look, the lineup had John Stones in midfield. Are you somebody that believes a lineup on a screen is how you play in possession or how you defend?
Well, that's a good question. I never look at it in formation, and because I got stung by looking at the BBC earlier this season, and it listed De Bruyne at centre half because of the players on the graphic. But when I see a lineup as like a list of names, I picture it in my head as that's how they're going to stand at kickoff.
So that's the thing for you, where to stand at kickoff, okay? And that's with kickoff or without it. Because again, that's a different...
That's different as well, and I don't know the answer to that.
So sometimes it's... I've done it before. Sometimes when I've gone, when I've switched from a three to a four, but when we get the kickoff, we line up as a four. So the opposition manager will look at it and say, oh, well, they're playing with a four. And then the next thing, it takes them 10 minutes to realise they're playing with a three.
Yeah,
or you're playing one up, they're playing two up, or you're playing three up. Mm. Within the flow of the game, it works itself out. But in the beginning, your mindset can change. Are they playing two up top?
Yeah, it's more so just for the John Stones thing, because whenever he's been in the team in the last, say, like couple of months, people for like ESPN and stuff, they'll ask me like, what's the formation here? And they say, is it like a 3-2 at the back? Yeah. I'm like, well, no, not really, because John Stones he's not a midfielder.
No.
And when they're defending, he's not defending from there. He's in the back four.
Yeah.
So that makes me think, he's like, is it a case of whether you want to be progressive or otherwise? But if you saw that sort of formation lineup and it said, here's the three and John Stones is there next to Rodri, do you perceive John Stones to be a midfielder in that game, or would you see him as a defender going into midfield?
I'd see him as a defender going into midfield.
So it's a back four then, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's this situation of back four out possession, back three in possession. I don't know what any of that means. It's just like it's just concept now, isn't it?
It's a nightmare to play against. It would be a nightmare. Yeah, like, who's going to pick up the centre back that's now playing in the eight? I don't know. You take it.
Yours.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Your man. Yeah. You figure this out.
Yeah. Well, speaking of nightmares to play against, let's talk about Erling Haaland. He needs one more Premier League goal to equal the best ever Golden Boot tally over a 42-game season. He's in a 38-game season, and we've not hit 38 games yet. He scored 33 Premier League goals from 53 shots on target. So he scored more goals from his shots on target than he's missed. And 102 shots in total. That's about a goal every third shot. And I did a bit of maths, and I tallied up your career goals between.
Here we go. Did you invite us on to do this?
Yeah. How many shots did I have?
I accept that you were both defenders. You scored 56 between you, so he's not far off.
Yeah, mostly Keith, though.
Mostly Keith, yeah. I'll give you that.
Mine were penalties.
Right, okay.
But still, you still got to score them. Yeah, that's the thing. We've talked about City adapting to Haaland and Haaland adapting to City. Where do you see that now at the moment, Keith? Because, I mean, last night was probably as close to perfection as you can probably get from him fitted into a City system, I guess, so far.
Yeah, apart from that, I think he'd probably be disappointed with the chances that he had last night that he didn't get more goals.
Yeah,
I think it's...
He seamlessly fitted in. I think everybody was saying that, like, had the success that City had before with playing without a centre forward, then would they be able to adapt them to play with a centre forward? And you've got to say that he has seamlessly fitted into that. That you think he's been there years, and the understanding that he's got with good players around him. He's
been there, what, 7-8 months, and he knows where De Bruyne is going to run, and De Bruyne knows where he's running. Yeah. And it's like that surely can't just come that instantly.
Again, I think sometimes people don't give the credit that Pep will be the work that he will be doing on the training ground, because it doesn't just happen. De Bruyne is excellent as a coach. You say about a number 10, you want a number 10 to arrive in those areas as number 10. Don't stand in the area, because you're easier to mark when you leave that area for you to go and work in. Phenomenal. But that takes, when you have a look at De Bruyne, most people in coaching, you say, like, know your next pass. He knows the next passages of play, so he knows he's going to go there, now I need to be in that area there. And his timing, his movement, how he arrives in the areas, phenomenal. And then having that link then, and understanding what other players are going to be doing, need to be doing, and what support they're going to do, it's phenomenal. Like, I love watching De Bruyne play, because he plays at his pace, but he has got a turn of pace as well. But he's one of those players that looks, he's always got time.
Yeah.
Always got time in critical areas as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was trying to work out from that opening goal, like, how he squeezed that in. And all I can come up with is that it's just a phenomenally well-placed shot. Because I don't think Rob Holding does that much wrong. And, like, he's bent it round him from 24 yards.
Was that Gabriel? I think it might have been Gabriel. With that goal, from where I was sitting, I thought it must have taken a deflection for someone to go to that side. But that's the skill of the man, because nobody's going to shoot to that near side. So I imagine Ramsdale probably thought to himself as well that it has to be going the other way. But the pinpoint finish to go in there. That's...
I must admit, like, when I first saw it, I thought it was, I thought Ramsdale will think he could. It'd be disappointing. Yeah. I think top goalkeeper.
Yeah, it's Ramsdale made so many saves.
Name another goalkeeper then?
No.
Because I meant Ramsdale. Yeah. If I didn't say Ramsdale,
you said talking about Holding.
Holding. Yeah, I meant Ramsdale. I was seeing Ramsdale.
We knew what you were on about.
Yeah. I think it's a different type of finish. Yeah. You know, most people wouldn't shoot from that distance to put it in there. I think that's maybe what's throwing him off, because 9 times out of 10, people are going to try and go across him or kick it really hard.
Yeah.
But the placement, it's like, it's magnificent.
Yeah.
I think, as well, like, we can't be too hard on Ramsdale. I think he was the only player that played well for Arsenal yesterday. And that's after conceding 4, which says a lot about the game itself. But, you know, you talked about the link-up between those two. I remember being at the Community Shield, listen to all that noise that came afterwards. Oh, Haaland's going to be a failure. De Bruyne's this, and timing's off.
You don't get the loose touches. You don't get that sort of time in the Premier League.
All that noise. Talk about, like, an industry of overreaction. There was so much noise. But then these guys, like, you know, we've seen them play probably 40 games together. But think how many times they've trained together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the relationships that some of these players have is not just something that comes out at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. There's a lot of work that goes in off behind the scenes as well. And that connection's there. And it's not just, you know, Haaland that's giving it to De Bruyne. You know, it's Grealish, it's Bernardo, it's Mahrez, it's Foden, it's Gundogan looking for him as well. And then when Kevin De Bruyne gets the ball, if I was playing up front, I'd be making a run in behind as well. Because lo and behold,
you're probably going to get it.
Yeah. Your feet, it's class. Like, I'll be honest, I'm a little bit biased. I've got a soft spot. I love Kevin. And I love the fact that we've got a 22-year-old up front who is brilliant now and will only get better as well.
Yeah. How would I, like, either of you are named in the opposition team, you've got Haaland up against you, what do you do?
Drop off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pull your hamstring or something like that.
You drop off and play narrow and you get everybody else in around you.
Yeah. You can't allow the game to be one that's played to his strengths.
No.
So if you're going to enter into a foot race with him, like, he's exceedingly fast and he's massive. You know what I mean? This guy's 6'4".
Yeah. You beat him?
In a race?
Yeah,
I'm quicker than him. I know, I'm quicker. But, like, what difference does it make when he's flipping, got his elbow just right in my in my throat, just running past? Because, you know.
But he plays on the shoulder as well, doesn't he?
Striker. And this is the downside, I think, of defending, is that you're always reactive to what they're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas the attacker knows the right time to run and things like this. So there's never really a race where you go to a gun. You're just always chasing somebody else. And he's magnificent. And worse, though, is the service that he gets. His little innate sense of where to be. And the fact he can just finish from anywhere, like, I don't know. It's not normal. It's not normal to have someone like that up front.
Again, just touching on it, I don't think you defend against him as an individual.
No, you can't.
You have to defend as a unit, which means then you have to defend narrow.
Yeah. That's why I think, in my opinion, City struggle the most against back fives and stuff like that. And it's not, when I say struggle, it's relative. It's very, very, very much relative.
They tend to beat them, but it's hard work.
Yeah, exactly, because they'll always have tons of bodies in there. And for Haaland, for as good as his movement is, you might beat one person, but then there's somebody else there as well.
Yeah.
And vice versa for like De Bruyne. They're trying to find those areas, but the space is less. Mm-hmm. So there's a greater emphasis on the wide men. But in games like yesterday, where they can go and just like dominate you centrally, That's hell enough.
Sheffield United did it well.
They did.
With a back five, and then they had their two wide midfield players out of possession. They went and sat in that hole to deny the number 10s.
Mm.
And again, they needed a penalty
to
break their deadlock. If they got to half-time, could have been a different game again. And then you have to see a different side of City when you're saying...
Could go break them down.
The only weakness that you see is City being countered on... teams don't have enough possession against them, but you can think of probably a few teams that if you're going to cause Man City a problem, it's going to be on the counter attack because you're not going to dominate them with the ball.
It's a high risk strategy though, sitting deep and defending the 18 though, because concede and like what comes next after that?
Is it high risk?
Well, okay, it's I don't know what the opposite of risk is. Reward.
I think it's a way to stay in the game for longer.
Yeah.
Because as you saw with Arsenal yesterday, there were times when people get frustrated and go and try to do the press.
Yeah.
And they do it by themselves.
Yeah.
But then that's a bigger risk because then it opens up a space for someone else to go and attack you. Yeah. Whereas if you've got the bodies in there, it's quite negative. But I remember at the semi-final, Kyle Walker made it into the box. He was about to put a cross in and I saw 8 Sheffield United shirts.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel at risk to me, you know. That feels like a level of security, which you know, to a certain extent, you'd need if you were a heavy underdog against them. But as Keith was saying, if you have an out ball, then you know before you know it, you can just hoof one long. Somebody can win
somebody
a free kick. Someone
it,
can
yeah.
get in behind, and that can be supported because, say, the game that City deserved to lose the most, I think, this season was the one against Brentford. It's because Ivan Toney basically put on a masterclass, and there were other players who were running up there with him, and they played with the back five, defended how they defended, but then boom, there's the danger. Like, you remember the point when it was De Bruyne versus 3 with like 5 minutes to go? Like, that's a team that's not high risk for them to be still having 5 players back, but they know that they've got the right setup to go and try and do something the other way, and as a consequence, I'd say that's the best plan for them.
Let's touch on Riyad Mahrez as well, because we not really covered the FA Cup semi-final, but he did score a hat-trick in there.
As you do.
Just pop up in the semi-final with a hat-trick. It's hard, isn't it, for Guardiola, because Mahrez is a fantastic player who's contributing so much, and then you look at the team on Wednesday night and you go, he probably deserves a place in there, but the plan that Pep's come up with, it's kind of like he doesn't fit into that plan for that game. And it's just like, it's one of those things where you've got to put your arm around a player and just go, look, I'm really sorry to do this, but you've scored a hat-trick and you ain't playing.
Again, I think that's management, when you have to make the decisions, but you don't make them for the individuals, you make them for the betterment of the team and your game plan. So Pep would have probably ideally had his game plan, his team selected for the Arsenal game before the semi-final game, regardless of the result. But it is difficult when you've got a player that's, you know, just scored a hat-trick, got you to the final of the cup, and then you've got to have that conversation when you're not playing. But that's about creating the environment whereby players understand manager picks a team for a reason. And then that's when you get that squad mentality that, I'm not playing this week, but I know I need to be ready because the week after,
I
might be starting. And keeping people on board, it is a skill, that man management skill of having that dialogue with players and creating that squad mentality. It's easy to say, you have a squad of 26, 27 players, but to keep everybody involved, keep everybody on their toes, and you can't just rotate players for the sake of it. You've got to be winning games.
Mm.
So again, that's the side of management that a lot of people don't understand. Maintaining that environment, crucial.
Is that rotation and that kind of that squad management through the season, is that the reason why City are now firing all cylinders, Nodem?
I'm sure it potentially plays into it, But as Keith was saying, like, the manager picks the best team for any particular game. Mm. You know, if it meant that it was going to be the same 11 for 10 games in a row, I think he would have done that. So I wouldn't necessarily say they would have been rotating at that point. Because, say, as we look back, there's certain players first who haven't been rotated. Rodri hasn't been rotated. You know what I mean? Haaland essentially hasn't been rotated. Yeah. So we can't really say it's like full rotation.
Yeah.
But there have been other players who haven't played for a spell, but there's tended to be a reason for that. Say when you look at, say when De Bruyne wasn't playing well for a bit, he wasn't really in the team as much. You know, there were some people who were being very critical of his performances. The usual.
I remember the headlines in February being how is City not playing a player like De Bruyne? It's like, have you watched him recently? He's just not firing.
He wasn't, and there could be a million different reasons for that. Yeah, there could be so many different reasons for that, and there've been other players as well. And as I say, we class it as rotation. He makes 3 or 4 changes for every game, but it's not just a case of rotation for the sake of it. I think the point that you made and Keith made about how it's the right player for the right moment in the right game, that's quite significant. Because then come the end of the season, maybe it looks like, you know, certain people have been rotated to build them into this spot, but it's not been that. And I think it's a privilege to have Bernardo, Mahrez, Foden, who can all play on that side, who are all three completely different players, but can help you win a game in three completely different ways. You know, that's amazing.
And I guess if you're the opposition, you look at that and you don't know which one of them they're going to pick. No, you don't know how they're going to attack
you.
Yeah,
but to comment on something which Guardiola said after the FA Cup semi, he said he's got a really good relationship with Riyad, and Riyad always lets him know when he's disappointed that he's not playing. And he said he really likes Riyad because he's got an amateur spirit.
Yeah.
The amateur spirit is the idea of how he just wants to play football. Mm. He has a football in his house. He plays football in his house. He'll be doing head tennis, all this stuff. Those people who just really love the game, I think you need those in a squad, because when you're playing 60 games a season, it can turn into just business, just games, just so on and so forth. But that true love for just being on the ball and doing whatever, like, credit to him for that. Because I'll be honest, towards the end of my career, I didn't have that. Mm. I had, like, the 15-year professional mindset, like, we've got a game. I have to do this, I have to do that.
I have to be ready for it.
I have to be ready. Amara's, you know, he'll understand that he has to be ready. But his sense of excitement about just being out on the training pitch, having the ball at his feet. Maybe it's because he's an attacker. You know what I mean? How much your spirit for defenders? Like, oh, let's work on some channel walls today. You know what I mean? Let's block some shots. But yeah, they're magnificent. And also, it then means we give a lot more credit to Jack Grealish.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't really get rotated. And it's because he's got a mix of all the things that all those guys on the other side have. He's got it in abundance, because I don't think he did that much yesterday in the game.
He did a lot off the ball, didn't he?
Yeah.
did you notice Grealish's discipline within the game plan of keeping his shape?
Yeah.
Whereas before, when he was at Villa, if he wasn't getting the ball, he would go wandering and he would go and find it and disrupt. And I think that's where Jack's maturing as a player and gaining that understanding of being involved in the squad and what his job is. Mm. His job yesterday was mainly, got to stay wide, you've got to keep our shape, you've got to give us that out ball, but if we need to switch play quickly. But again, that's that understanding of the game.
There was another job in there, which
the
seemed to be... It seemed to be wind up the Arsenal players as soon as he can.
he did a good defensive play as well in the first half.
Yeah. With Kanji.
With Kanji and Saka, yeah. And he's done that a few times in recent times.
I think it was in the first half where I saw him sprinting. He must have had a 75-yard sprint to get back into a defensive position. I'm thinking, wow.
That's somebody that wants
I wish I had somebody like that in front of me.
That's a player that's buying in.
Yeah, 100%.
Which is what you need.
Exactly.
Get a dollop of City nostalgia every Monday. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's have a look ahead now, because City play Fulham and West Ham this week. We talked a bit earlier on about it all being about focus now and being ready for these games. Equally, mentally, how key would it be to go back to the top of the table this weekend? Because Chelsea don't play till Tuesday.
You mean Arsenal?
Arsenal don't play till Tuesday.
Are you projecting here?
Yes.
Yes. Like, I gathered you would be.
I would like to go back to the top of the table.
Yeah, that's what I mean. How good it'd be for me as a fan of City to see them at the top of the table.
Top of the table, game in hand, sit back, relax.
I don't know. They could touch the top of the table, but then they could be off it by Tuesday night as well. Yeah. But I think they understand, and this is what makes them so great, that it's not about like doing half a job. It's about doing the whole thing. You know, they know that if they win their games between now and the end of the season, they could finish on, like, with it being an historic season.
Yeah.
But if they lose a game, changes everything again.
Yeah.
If they drop points, changes everything again. And they're playing against teams who've got their own sort of, like, agendas and stuff which they want to complete themselves. So, you know, they might have, you know, a day off today because they're playing on Sunday, aren't they? Chance to reset. But that Arsenal game is 3 points, just like the game on the weekend. It's, you don't get extras for beating a game against Arsenal. So
I think, do deny them the chance to make up ground on you, though.
After beating Arsenal?
Yeah.
Yeah, but then what use is that if they drop points on the weekend? Because before you know it, it's the race changes again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then in the space of... So I've loved this last week because everything's fallen favourably for City. They beat Bayern. They won in the semi-final. Yeah. They beat Arsenal. Three different games in three different competitions, three wins that provide a big boost for this final stage of the season with basically a month to go. But they still have to do things and get things to happen. And it'd be the... Like, Arsenal have dropped points against three sides before this. Who wouldn't expect them to? People believe City won't do that because for years they could take the 3 points off everyone. It's not just the case of the ones against their rivals. So they'll go there. It'll be a game which they'll be more uncomfortable in because it's all the Fulham fans being there. Mm. But if they play anywhere near their potential, then they'll be okay. But they still have to get themselves up to near their potential because the Premier League's a far different outfit to, say, playing Sheffield United, who in some ways maybe were just happy to be in that semi-final.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the competitions as a whole as well, Keith, there is an element of a balancing act now between the Premier League because the Champions League draw, Real Madrid, it's like, there's a lot from last season to unpack there. It's a tough challenge as well. And then you've got a Manchester Derby FA Cup final.
Yeah, I think this is the demands that the manager and the consistency of those demands that the manager puts on the squad. Because will he be settling now for? Well, yeah, well, like I said, we won the semi final, did well in the Champions League, beat Arsenal. That will not lessen his demands that he puts on those players. Will he expect, or will he have any expectations of those players coming in and having a down day? No, it's a focus group. Very much so, maintaining that focus of winning the next game. That winning mentality. The winning mentality is not just about having the ability to win games. It's doing what needs to be done in the lead-up, mentally, physically, your preparation to go out and perform. Being able to perform gives you the opportunity to be a winner. If you don't set yourself targets and prepare properly, then you can't win games consistently. Man City will and do win games consistently, and that's because of the preparation, the mental approach that Pep has on that group, his group. When you go in and you're a player at Man City, you've got expectations and you do what needs to be done.
And if you don't buy in, you're not there. Yeah,
very, very simple. Don't play.
Yeah, for sure. And I think Pep is obviously a big driver in that and the staff around him, but then the players have been there for a long time as well.
Yeah.
You know, so they've appreciated these big games towards the end of the season. And it would be a huge surprise to me if all of a sudden they're celebrating the game against Arsenal like that's the final game of the season. Like, they know the bigger picture and what it takes, because very quickly, like, they've been involved in times where they've been miles ahead, times when they've been doing the chasing, but they know it's not over until it's over.
Yeah.
You know, so as a consequence, the manager could say this is how it has to be, but I think other players will be saying it as well because they've done it so many times now.
Yeah. As players, do you live for those games?
I'd love to.
The pressure games where you have to win.
I'll be honest. So yesterday's game was the first game which I just went to casually. Yeah. And I'd had a buzz about that game for 2 days prior.
Yeah.
And the last time I felt that was when I was playing in big games myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you're sort of looking, counting down as a sense of excitement and... You know, the crowd were up for it. They had the big banners and so on. You know that everybody's watching that game of football.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Because essentially, it's 22 players on a field, which can happen down the road in Salford somewhere. But all of a sudden, you see the real big fact that this game, even though it's 4-3 points, it's a key one in terms of Pete and audience. And that, for me...
Going in, it's the two best teams in England so far this season.
It's the best... The rush, for me, of a big game is so high. That's why some of the best games I ever played were the biggest games.
Yeah.
Because you have to find something more because the test is so much different, so much harder, you know, and you understand the level of importance. So it's basically like a cup final, it's not a cup final.
Yeah.
You know, and people dream of doing that. Like, if you're playing in the end, towards the end of the season and nothing matters.
Yeah.
You're not going through the motions, but when you're playing for something at the end of the season.
Is that
you never phone it in, but like, those seasons are a lot harder to remember.
I think it's the fear factor in football. Mm. You know, when you get some players that can't handle that fear factor.
Yes, it's true.
Some players thrive in it.
A lot of fans can't handle it either. Yeah.
I must admit, I was looking at the game yesterday, and I was 90% confident, but I had that 10% doubt. I'm thinking, if Arsenal turn up, Could it be a draw? Could they sneak a 1-0?
Yeah.
So that 10% hesitancy, but I enjoy that. But that's that fear factor.
Yeah.
Some players can't handle that fear factor because you get somebody like, well, we're guaranteed to go and win. They get that overconfident and then they can't handle it when they go 1-0 down.
Yeah.
So sometimes you need to be able to operate 90-95%, but some players can't handle that fear factor.
Yeah.
Some managers can't. I know a lot of managers and coaches, they love Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
The coaching, but then Saturday, they don't enjoy game day.
Yeah.
Where I was completely different. Well, I am completely different as a coach. I love match days. I love the thrill and the buzz of match day, of winning, competing, and solving problems on a match day when the team comes out, they're playing against a different team, a different formation, different players that have been playing, and then you think, right, now we need to work this out, chaps.
Yeah. What I would say in regards to that as well, to make it relatable to fans, is that in all the run-ins that they've seen from City, they always remember the biggest games.
Yeah.
You know, you can't necessarily remember the ones before or after.
Do you get nervous these days ahead of big games? Because
as a fan. It's different. I think because I have to work in the media, there's a sense of not necessarily anxiety around it, but like a real wish for it to be positive.
Yeah.
Because if it's not positive, I know how I'm going to be sort of treated in the media from that standpoint.
Yeah.
Almost as if I've played in the game myself.
Yeah.
And you're going to be blasted for what something else is that's happened
that you've got no control over.
Yeah, but
because I only ask because I had a reset in how I thought last season. I'm sounding like a hippie now, I know, but I completely changed my line of thinking. Where I used to get really nervous in the running ahead of big games, and I discovered it was because I was asking the question, "What if we lose?" Where the actual question is, "What if we win?"
Yeah, I think that is not typical City. What's going on in your mind?
Yeah.
So maybe you are a hippie. Because you can't help but always think about the worst case scenario. Like even yesterday, it goes 3-1, it's the 86th minute. Even myself, I was looking at the clock. And why were there groans when the 5-minute board went up?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I did say at that point, though, you know what? Point still keeps it in our hands.
That's what I mean. So that's the typical City thing that exists in people's minds. And like the City have battered them for like 86 minutes. And it's like, oh, flipping heck.
Have you ever heard that expression, negativity courts company?
Yeah.
And that's what it is.
That's 55,000 people in a stadium bowl, isn't it?
No, it couldn't, could it?
Yeah, you get drawn in. You can't help but think about that. So, I it's not nervousness. In fact, no, maybe it is because, like, when you're playing and you're in a squad, like, there's a big difference between being on the bench for a big game, being on the field.
Yeah.
On the field, as soon as the game starts, you're not nervous.
Yeah.
You're just playing a game of football.
Yeah.
When you're on the side,
when you can't affect it.
You can't affect it and you're seeing it and you know it affects you in the bigger scale. Like, it doesn't feel the same. The game feels more intense. Feels like everything's going on. Feels like you're under more pressure. Like, I was lucky yesterday because I was sitting higher so I could see the game fully for what it was. Whereas usually I'm a bit lower. So it feels like, this is good, that's good. But yeah, I was more at ease because I could see it fully. But like that nervousness, it sort of brings out the best in you. I think it brings out the best in the fans, brings out the best in the players and brings those moments together whereby, as I say, people at City remember that performance and that result between now and the end of the season, same way they might do if they beat Real Madrid in the semi-final.
Yeah, but if you have a cut and dry 2-0 at Fulham this weekend, it's like, okay, job done, but it's
exactly,
not going to stick in the memory.
Exactly.
I think it's embracing those nerves.
Mm.
You get some people, they fall apart with it. You've got to be able to embrace, like, you're bound to be nervous. There's nothing wrong with being nervous. Yeah. I say it before games now. You walk into the changing room and you know it's a big game for the team, and then you ask the players and you say, like, are you nervous? And they think, oh, what do I need to say? The manager asks me, they say no. And then I tell them, I am.
Yeah.
Stop lying to
me.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with being nervous. You know that. I played some of my best games when I was nervous.
Yeah. I think it shows that you're keen to do well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you're nervous
about
playing well, not going well. But when you're nervous, like, this is the thing. Even if it's like, transfer it to a different sport, like, people get nervous on the first tee and like playing the local like golf course.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that deep, mate. But like, you really want to play well.
Yeah.
So that's why the anxiety sort of kicks in.
Do you play golf?
I do, yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, I think we need to have a game. What do you play off?
Well, I play off about 10. I just recorded a YouTube golf thing, which will be coming out soon this morning. And I played well, to be fair. So, yeah.
Good.
You be careful what you wish for.
I played yesterday at Prestbury Golf Club.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
I want to know the outcome to this.
There's
now
an invitation there.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Happily go.
We have to set this up.
Happily.
Before we move on, we've got the charity bet coming up. So let's have some score predictions from each of you for, first off, the Fulham away game. What you go for, Keith?
2-0.
2-0 City?
3-1 City.
3-1 City. That leaves me with not many options, but I will say 2-1 City. A little bit tighter.
Okay.
And then West Ham at home as well, Keith?
I know David Moyes. I used to play with David. He will set his team up to be very competitive, but I think he'll have the door opened, and I think it could be 4-4.
Really?
4-0, 4-1, 4-2?
4-0.
4-0.
I'm going to say 2-1.
2-1?
Yeah.
Or I'll take 3-1 then. In
okay. Do you know why I say 1 all the time?
Because if... I know why, because I do it as well. Where so take this game, I've said 3-1. If West Ham open the scoring in the first minute,
you're still in with a
I'm
chance.
Not out of the game.
Yeah. Is that the thing? Is that the thing you're always in with a chance even when something bad happens? Yeah.
Always hedge your bets. That's my advice. Exactly. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more information on responsible gambling, take a look at begambleaware.org. Going to finish. We've asked for a few questions for you both to finish. So Steve O'Brien on the emails says, on penalties, this new way of watching the keeper move and then calmly slotting it the other way. Does anyone on the panel remember anybody doing this prior to Mario Withers? I wondered if Alano did it.
No, Alano didn't do it. He used to take a slow run up, but then just smash it into the corner. Yeah. Until he smashed about 4 into the corner, and I think we were like at Bolton away, and the keeper thought he was going to smash it in the same corner. He rolled it 1 mile an hour on the other side. I was like, he'll make it, this fella. He'll make it, yeah. But I've seen more people do it recently, and it's a good skill, to be fair.
Yeah, and Keith, you took penalties. Mm. What do you make of it? Just get up there and smash it, or...?
I'll just quickly recap. We were 1-0 down, Old Trafford. Terry Feeling got sent off. We get a penalty. So I put the ball down, and I mentally had this routine in my head of what I was doing. And then I made the fatal mistake of looking up and seeing Peter Schmeichel. And I thought, you look big. Mm. You look very big. And so I put the ball down, walked back, and I've gone, split second, you know, they say don't change your mind. Yeah. And I've gone, I know he knows I'm going to his left. And then that's I change it, and then I've gone like, no, do what you normally do, and I've just put a top corner, and I'm like thinking, if I'd gone the other way, I know I felt I would have missed.
Yeah.
I still remember it now.
Could you have waited for him to move and then played it?
No, because it was about me. I knew where I was going to put the ball, and I had to have that mindset of, because if he'd gone that way and then I went, oh, now I'll change my mind. No, but again, I think penalty taking is, people may not remember, Matt Letizier. He was absolutely phenomenal, and he could put the ball wherever he wanted. I took penalties. Very rarely did I change. I think probably the only, but one of the goalkeepers that didn't go the right way or go the opposite way was Simon Tracy. Mm. And he's one of those. I tried giving him the eyes, putting the ball down, looking that way. I'm going to put it that way and put it out. I'm going to smash it. And he just totally oblivious. He said he didn't catch me. He didn't see me giving him the eyes. He was lucky on that day. did you used to take penalties yourself?
No. So everything you described there is my worst nightmare. So if I was to be stepping up for a penalty,
If it's a shootout, what number are you likely to be?
Listen, 11.
11?
11. Like, for me, I used to, this is my opinion. Yeah. So the under 21s, 2009, we practiced penalties all summer.
Yeah.
And to the keeper's right, I always struck it well,
yeah,
but it was always saved.
Yeah.
To the keeper's left, it would always go in, but it was never near the corner.
Yeah.
So when it came to a penalty shootout, Stuart Pearce, manager at the time, he had a list of everyone to go in their order, and he knew where everyone scored and missed,
yeah,
to the point where he was going to tell us where we should kick the ball.
Yeah.
And I was so worried that if I went to the keeper's left and the keeper went that way, it'd be the worst penalty you've ever seen in all your days. But thankfully, it didn't get to me and we got through. But in my mind, I think they're two different types of people. There are the ones who are excited about scoring, yeah, and the ones who are nervous about missing.
Yeah.
And I was very much the latter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was nowhere near a penalty shooter. If I was on the field and our team won one, I'd be in the stands just to make sure nobody knew that. I had nothing to do with it, my friend. Yeah. Nothing at all.
I think there's nothing better than having that, you know, when you put the ball down on the spot and you know that everybody in the whole stadium is looking at you.
Yeah, that's the worst. That's my worst nightmare.
Is it? Oh, no, I enjoyed nightmare. That. And then you need that strength, the courage and your convictions of where you're going to put it. If the goalkeeper saves it, great save.
Yeah, I'd always worried that the goalkeeper would look at me and say, "I know where you're going to go." I'd be like, "Oh crap, what do I do now?" Because it's the whole bluff, double bluff. Well, what happens if he does?
Yeah,
and then, Joe Hart used to do that, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's why
I know where you're going. Him.
Yeah, and most of the time he did kind of know. He wouldn't necessarily always save it. But it does. You just think about that for a second, like everyone listening. If a goalie says he knows where you're going to go and is a very good goalie, what would you do? Just think about that. What would you do?
Goalkeeper, though, I love penalties, so I can't lose.
The goalkeepers can't.
Yeah, easiest job in the world.
Helen on Twitter says, both Keith and Nadum came back to play against City after leaving. What's it like coming back to an old club? Can players ever offer insight into strengths and weaknesses or what certain ex-teammates are like or if easy to wind up?
Yeah, definitely. Again, when you're at a club, I think I was at City for 5 years and then I left and went to Wolves and came back. I knew the club inside out. I don't think as a reflection on the result per se, but I think you can have an influence if you're a player that had good stature at the football club. I think you can give that confidence to your teammates in and around you if you're a presence, if that's the type of personality that you are. Which did I enjoy going back to City? Yeah, I did. I did go back because I knew what the football club was like. I was lucky. I got a good welcome as well. Even though some people do say that I left on bad terms, it wasn't. I think we had a conversation earlier on that where the timing of when I left, when the club got relegated, wasn't my choice. I still had two years left on my contract. I wanted to stay. It was a decision by the football club that they were going down a route whereby they had to change the finances of the football club. In the modern day now, when they're saying that I was overpaid at the time or earning too much money at the time now, you think, wow.
Yeah, I retired too early, didn't I?
Yeah, exactly. For me, going back for the first time was really weird because it's all I'd ever known. Yeah. You know, I was in the academy from the age of 10. So then to go back and play there, it's weird to call the Etihad away, you know, to see some of the people working for City and to see that, like, I'm not the person that's here anymore. That was strange. But then in regards to, like...
Is that hard to...
It depends if you support the club or not. So for me, that actually supported the club properly, like... It was a bit weird because I'm close with everyone that was there because I've been friends with them for years. Coming back for the first time, you don't really support it. It's like, you know, it is whatever it is. But the insight thing, I think it only goes so far because, say, when I came back with QPR, I could say to my teammates, Sergio Aguero likes to do this, Yaya Toure likes to do that, David Silva likes to do that. But
doesn't mean he will.
Yeah, no, not even that. Like, so what? They're still better than us. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we can say what their tendencies are, but it doesn't mean that you can instantly negate them because that, like, when we came as QPR, we were the team that was 17th in the Premier League, going up against a team that dropped 2 points at home all season. Listen, I could tell them exactly what they do. Tell them how they brush their teeth if you wanted. But realistically, how does that mean that we're going to be able to stop you? Like, the matchup in midfield was like Sean Derry plus another versus Yaya Toure and Gareth Barry. You're still overmatched regardless of whether you tell someone what they're going to do or not. Like, David Silva's a genius. If I say that, it's like me saying, think of it this way. It's the simplest way to describe it. I said to the left back or whatever, oh, with David Silva, he prefers to go on his left. That's, now what?
That's it, standard.
Yeah. Now what? What more can you say?
Yeah, like, well, you've prepped him as much as you want.
Exactly, yeah. So the insight's there and you can say stuff, but sometimes for the way City are, especially at that time, they're just so much better than everybody else that ultimately you can tell them what they're going to do, but it doesn't mean you're going to be able to stop it.
Yeah. Final question comes from John on Twitter, who says, people talk about the impact of negative stories in the press before big games. How much is the dressing room even aware of them?
Of big stories?
Yeah.
A lot of players nowadays, they live on social media. They're aware of it, what effect it has on it. Not really sure now because I think the modern day footballer now, they know that they're living in a goldfish bowl. Why let the truth spoil a good story? Probably 90% of what's said or what's printed or publicised isn't true. And I think the players nowadays, they deal with that.
They just brush it off.
Negativity courts company. If you allow something, somebody else's opinion, somebody else's view, somebody else's thoughts affect you as an individual, then that's a different issue for you to deal with.
What is the negative story?
Well, I'm interested in your thoughts because you've talked about player ratings before and how like seeing player ratings in the papers and online can affect you. Just a negative story in the sense of, I guess, I don't know, maybe an opinion piece that
about the individual,
about the individual, or about the club, or about the performance.
It might be, but everybody now will have an opinion on what Arsenal's mindset is going to be and where they've potentially lost it. Not won it in the last four games. Now, if you get involved in that negativity,
it just spirals.
It can spiral. Be an individual. Have your own thoughts. Have your own opinions. You know if you've played well. You know if you haven't won in four games and you're at the top of the table and you're trying to go to win the title. You know you need to win a game.
I think in regards to that, you could try and say, have the blinkers on and disregard anything that's being said on social media and the like, but say a manager of a football club, especially at the sort of highest division, they're doing press conferences all the time, and some of the narrative, the external narratives get delivered to you whether you pay attention or not. Like someone, it'd be the nature of the question. So Mikel, it's been four games now where your team haven't managed to win, and as a consequence, it looks like you guys are really low on form. How does this feel, blah, 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 blah? And he'll have to answer that question, and the players will probably see him answer that question, but the manager's not had that thought, but somebody's presented a thought onto them.
Yeah.
And I think there's a big disconnect between how we perceive football from the outside versus how they do it on the inside. Like, they might be low on confidence, but they also might believe that they're going to go through and win the league still, you know. But when you always ask the questions from your own perspective, it's almost like, well, of course, this is the way that they think. And I think it can affect some people when you're not doing so well. But ultimately, a lot of the people who talk about it, like, whenever I talk about football, I always, like, have this little caveat that I don't have a clue what's going on, yeah? I can give my opinion about what I think is going on, but unless one of those people's talking to you openly about how a situation is, you don't have
really
a clue.
Yeah.
I do not know. We can speculate, but we do not know. We can talk about my past experiences, but I do not know. So when other people who haven't been involved in the game, haven't played the game for a second, deliver really big opinions, negative, positive, whatever, do you think people look to them for validation?
I think when Guardiola gets asked a question like that, he gives the eyes, doesn't he?
Yeah, because he knows it's like, it's you know what I mean? It's like, it's crap. Like, some of it's crap. But then in the same breath, I think some fans get really upset about other people's opinions when they don't need to.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lady, I apologise if she's listening, I forgot your name, I'm sorry. But she was upset because Dion Dublin thought that Arsenal were going to win the game yesterday. And she said, people are rooting against us, want us to lose. I said, he doesn't want you to lose. I said, ultimately, he's had to make a prediction about a game of football. And there's a big difference between what you sort of predict and what you want to happen. Because the prediction doesn't come with a want. You won't find them saying, I want Arsenal to win this game. It's like, this is my prediction based on X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
That's it. You know?
I still think Dion's doing well on Holmes under the hammer.
Yeah, exactly. But then instead, you're like, they take offence to it. But it's not, it's like a game prediction, and most of the time we're wrong. Yeah. Start of the year, we've got to do a top six or top four prediction. I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But whatever I put, like, all the Chelsea fans a year ago were disgusted by me putting them in fourth. Disgusted.
And that's responsible. Take fourth now, wouldn't
they? Listen, that's responsible with a few of them saying, just in case you didn't know, this was before a ball was kicked. I had no idea. Okay.
Yeah.
So everyone thinks they're going to do well. Unfortunately, not everyone can do well in a season.
Yeah. Who would have thought beginning of the season that Brighton and Villa would be above Chelsea and Liverpool? Who would have predicted that?
It's crazy.
What we're learning here is that things like this are just background noise and people shouldn't be listening to us, and somehow we've got to 500 episodes.
Can I say, by the way, I think anyone that's listened to all 500 needs to reach out to you because they deserve a round of applause.
I've been doing a little bit of housekeeping and kind of updating a record of the podcast that we've done. I'm only up to the end of season 10. And to listen to all of them, it's taken a fortnight of your life so far.
Yeah.
So, honestly... Like, why are you still here? Why are you all still here?
I find it curious that you started the podcast after I left City.
No, you were there. You were there. 2009, you were there.
Yeah, well, I thought you said 10 before. I find it curious, my friend. But still, you carry on.
Yes, well, that brings us to an end of this very, very special Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you to my guests for this one, Nader Manua.
Absolute pleasure, sir.
And Keith Cole.
Pleasure.
And a big thank you as well for sticking with the show all these years to get us to 500 episodes. Here's to the next 500.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
It's become a bit of like a legendarily terrible performance now, like probably because, not necessarily because of how bad it actually was, because I think it's because of how, like, he went from a 10 out of 10 performance to a 1 out of 10 performance. I'm sure he felt on top of the world after the Chelsea game, but it's very easy to then feel like you're 2 inches tall after that whole game. And I think that probably, like you say, is where it then spiraled, and then the fan backlash of, you know, Soz pal not worked out, you're just not suited to the Prem. That kind of thing just then becomes a big a bigger thing. And no matter what you can do after a certain amount of time, the fans have, to some degree, made their mind up about you, and there's not really anything you can do to change it.
Just as a quick aside, seriously, mate, no joking. Please just don't play again. Prem not suited to you, pal. You're crap. No hard feelings. Just not worked out. Yeah, that was. I think the thing that makes it awful is that it's like, it's really, really cutting about his ability, but it's like, just no hard feelings. It just hasn't worked out. It's like, it's the sympathy side of it as well.
It's that I feel sorry for you, not you're bad. It's I feel sorry for you, which, like you say, often worse.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.